A lot of products say they're clean, but what does that mean? Ritual has high standards for what clean means. Like their essential prenatal multivitamin, which is heavy metal tested, clean label project certified, and GMO free. It features key mom to baby nutrients like folate, choline, and omega-3. Clean isn't clean enough, especially during pregnancy. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The year is 1977, the year that gave us Star Wars, the Rumours album from Fleetwood Mac, the mainstream rise of both punk rock and disco, which is weird, and the Amityville Horror, the book and later the film that would put Ed and Lorraine Warren in the national spotlight. This was also the year when the events in the Enfield poltergeist case in England shocked and amazed the British media, as well as paranormal investigators on both sides of the Atlantic. In the second film in the Conjuring series, we follow the Warrens as they travel to England to assist the Hodgson family, who are experiencing terrifying activity at their council house in Enfield. The Hodgson family, mother Peggy, her two daughters Janet and Margaret, and sons Johnny and Billy, begin to experience the strange occurrences after Janet and Margaret play with a Ouija board. Then Janet sleepwalks and speaks with the entity of an angry elderly man who seems attached to an old armchair that came with the house. Eventually, after the media gets involved in the case, Janet becomes seemingly possessed by the old man, whose name is Bill Wilkins. He'd lived and died in their house. The Warrens became involved after they're asked to determine whether Janet's possession is a hoax, although they're reluctant to do so, because Lorraine has recently had a vision about Ed's death. She's also, and will have it again in England, a vision of a demonic nun, which Ed had recently dreamed about. While staying at the Hodgson house, Ed and Lorraine consult with other paranormal investigators, including Morris Gross and Anita Gregory, who doubt the reality of it, especially after Anita captures video evidence of Janet wrecking the kitchen on purpose. After Ed and Lorraine see the video, they also leave, believing the family is lying for money and fame. However, they discover that the spirit of Bill Wilkins is only a pawn being manipulated by the true demon, that scary nun who's trying to destroy Janet. Lorraine's abilities have been blocked by the nun while at the house, preventing her from seeing the truth of Janet's possession. The Warrens quickly return to the Hodgson residence and find Janet possessed, standing at the window ready to commit suicide. Ed grabs Janet, but is close to falling. Lightning strikes the tree in the yard, turning it into a stump, which Lorraine had seen in her vision of Ed's death. He fell on the stump and was impaled on it. But Lorraine saves the day by finding a Bible in which she had written the demon's name after her vision. It's Valak. She addresses the demon by its name, gaining power over it, and successfully sending it to hell. Or at least on to the next sequel. Janet is freed from her possession and she is pulled to safety so that Ed and Lorraine can return home and add a haunted Crooked Man zoetrope toy owned by Peggy's youngest child to their museum, right next to the Annabelle doll in the music box from the first movie. That's pretty wild, right? I mean, in the opening scroll, it assures us this film is based on a true story. So all this must have happened, or at least we're supposed to believe that it did. But as we all know, real life is often different when it comes to movies, especially when the Warrens are involved. In fact, based on the plot summary of the film that I just gave you, pretty much nothing after the words, "the Warrens became involved," actually occurred. Like the first Conjuring film, there isn't much, aside from the names of the people involved, that carry over from reality to the film. So how much of the true story made it into this based on a true story film? Well, as you're about to hear, not much, which is too bad. If the film had been more about the traumatic events experienced by this family and less about the filmmakers trying to paint the Warrens as heroic figures and setting up sequels for the franchise, it would have been a much more frightening film. But then again, without those things, would it have actually been made at all? Probably not, but it should have been. Between 1977 and 1979, the story of what was happening in that house in North London shocked the people of England and later the people of America too. The bizarre events baffled police officers, psychics, paranormal experts, and skeptical reporters alike. It allegedly involved levitation, furniture flying through the air, moving objects, cold breezes, physical assaults, water appearing on the floor, and even items bursting into flames. A policewoman signed an affidavit that she had seen a chair move by itself, and she was just one of more than 30 witnesses to the events, which unfolded for more than a year behind the door of an ordinary-looking house on a suburban street of identical houses. And it left those involved permanently scarred. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most unsettling films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever appeared on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season will offer the true story behind these terrifying films, which are usually even scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 9 of season 9, The Conjuring, part 2. The events at the Hodgson House began on the evening of August 30th, 1977. It was in the home of Peggy Hodgson and her four children, Margaret, who was 13, Janet, who was 11, Johnny, who was 10, and Billy, who was 7. That night, Peggy was anxious to get the children to bed, even though Janet started complaining that her bed was shaking, and so were the beds of her brothers. Assuming this was just a delay to prolong bedtime, Peggy ordered them into bed, and she thought no more about this until the following evening, when something more disturbing occurred. Peggy heard excited laughter coming from upstairs, and she went to tell the children to settle down. When she went into the room, the children told her they heard noises coming from the floor. Janice said it sounded like a chair moving, so Peggy took the only chair out of the room and placed it downstairs. Hoping this would settle them down, she began getting ready for bed. Then she heard the same shuffling sound that Janet had claimed she and her siblings had heard. Peggy hurried to the children's room, assuming they were acting up again, but found them asleep. Then she heard four distinct knocks from the wall. She turned on the light and saw nothing out of the ordinary until a heavy chest of drawers slid out away from the wall. Startled, she pushed it back into place, only to have it shoot out toward her again, propelled, she believed, by some invisible force. Shaken by the incident, Peggy woke up the children, got them dressed, and took them next door to the home of their neighbors, Vic and Peggy Nottingham. Vic, a rugged construction worker, went next door to investigate. He also heard the noises, knocking sounds in the bedroom, in the walls, and the ceiling. "I was beginning to get a little frightened," he later confessed. Unsure of what else to do, the Hodgsons called the police, who were equally mystified. Police Constable Carolyn Heaps, who responded to the call at the Hodgson home, saw a chair move, and in a report she noted that, quote, "a large armchair moved, unassisted, 4 feet across the floor." She inspected the chair for hidden wires, but could find no explanation for how it had happened or what she'd seen. Eventually, the officers left, telling the family the incidents were not really a police matter, since they couldn't find anyone who was breaking the law. Well, the next day brought more strange happenings, so the Hutchins and their neighbors called the press. The Daily Mirror sent a photographer and reporter to look into things, and they stayed for several hours. Daily Mirror photographer Graham Morris said, "It was chaos. Things started flying around. People were screaming." Some of the events were captured on film, and the images were disturbing. One photo showed Janet apparently being thrown across the room. In others, her face is contorted in pain. The BBC also visited the house, but the crew discovered that the metal components in their recording equipment had been twisted somehow, and the recordings erased. The press got the attention of the Society for Psychical Research, or the SPR, England's first paranormal research society. It sent investigators Morris Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair to take a closer look at the case and try to determine what was happening. Guy had a lot of past experience with poltergeist cases, and he would later write a book about the Hodgson case. Morris Gross later said, "As soon as I got there, I realized the family was in a bad state. Everybody was in chaos." The investigators soon found themselves in the middle of the apparent psychic activity. They witnessed levitating furniture, chairs spun around and flung around the room, and family members hurled from their beds at night. In an interview, Morris later recalled, "When I first got there, nothing happened for a while. Then I experienced Lego pieces flying across the room and marbles, and the extraordinary thing was, when you picked them up, they were hot." On the night of September 8th, Morris and three reporters were keeping watch when they heard a crash in Janet's bedroom. They discovered that her bedside chair had been thrown several feet across the room. Janet was asleep at the time, or so it appeared, and no one else was in the room to see the chair move. However, it happened again, an hour later, and this time, one of the photographers captured the incident on film. Shortly after this, Morris was joined by Guy Playfair, and the two men spent the next year studying the case. While the two men maintained the reality of the events they witnessed, they also found reason to doubt some of the claims that were made. Along with two skeptical SPR investigators, they tried to debunk many of the events by finding a natural cause for them. One of the other SPR investigators dismissed the entire case as a hoax, while another described it as overrated, believing that several incidents had been staged. Morris and Guy agreed about some of the alleged phenomena. At one point, they caught Janet and Margaret bending some spoons and once saw Janet toss an item across the room to make a noise. And years later, Janet admitted, "Oh yeah, we did it once or twice, just to see if Mr. Gross and Mr. Playfair would catch us. They always did." Whether real or faked, the events were reportedly chilling to witnesses. Aside from banging on the walls, things flying about, and furniture moving on its own, Janet was said to have levitated off her bed and to have spoken in a voice purportedly belonging to a man named Bill Wilkins, who had died in the house before the Hodgsons moved in. The male-sounding voice came out of Janet's mouth, and it said, "Just before I died, I went blind. Then I had a hemorrhage, and I fell asleep, and I died in that chair in the corner afterwards." The voice was recorded by Morris Gross, and it sounded probably a lot scarier than what you just heard. But anyway, bizarrely, the son of Bill Wilkins, Terry, later confirmed what was described was accurate. It seems impossible that this could have been something Janet would have known. But was there actually a ghost haunting the house, or had Janet, or even Peggy, tapped into something in the energy of the building? The case had a lot of similarities to other poltergeist incidents. That's usually described as a paranormal event that allowed energy in the human mind to create physical activity. It seemed like it could be happening because of a ghost, but the theory was that it was a person who was unknowingly causing it. And in most cases, poltergeist attacks occurred around teenage boys and girls, around the time of puberty, who were dealing with behavioral or psychological issues. In this case, there were two young girls in the house, around the age of puberty. There was a lot of tension in the house, too. Peggy had never resolved her feelings about her divorce from the children's father and was under a lot of pressure as a single mother. The family was stuck in a terrible situation with little money and even less support. Janet and Margaret were often teased, and their younger brothers were bullied and picked on. Janet even had a short stay at the Maudsley Psychiatric Hospital in London, and she later said, "I was bullied at school. They called me Ghost Girl. I dread going home. The front door would be open, there'd be people in and out. You didn't know what to expect, and I used to worry a lot about Mom." She had a nervous breakdown in the end. It would be a priest's visit to the house, not Ed and Lorraine Warren, that brought an end to the worst of it. Tensions were eased and things began quieting down in the fall of 1978. The family later maintained that the occurrences did not stop entirely, and Peggy continued to report noises in the house. Janet's younger brother, Billy, who lived in the house until 2003, remarked that he always felt like he was being watched. After Billy moved out, a woman named Claire Bennett and her four sons moved into the house. Like Janet's younger brother, Claire claimed that she always felt as if someone was watching her. During the night, her children were awakened by voices that seemed to be coming from downstairs. The final straw came when her 15-year-old son woke up one night, saw a man enter his room, and then vanish. They moved out the next day. They'd only lived in the house for 2 months. But no matter what Janet, Billy, Claire Bennett, or anyone else said, not everyone was convinced the haunting had been real. Janet's disembodied voice was always one of the most criticized parts of the case. In one interview for BBC Scotland, Janet was observed to gain attention by waving her hands and then putting her hand in front of her mouth while she claimed the voice was heard. Morris Gross made tape recordings of Janet and believed there was no trickery involved. However, stage magicians who specialized in ventriloquism dismissed the recordings as nothing, quote, beyond the capabilities of an imaginative child. According to Janet and others in later interviews, tests were performed with her mouth filled with water, though, and the voices were still heard. Skeptics have picked apart the tape recordings that Morris made, the photographs, and really anything else about the case, including what they say is the gullibility of the investigators. Magician Milburn Christopher briefly investigated the Enfield occurrences and failed to observe anything that he would call paranormal. He was dismayed by what he felt was suspicious activity on the part of Janet, and he later concluded, "The poltergeist was nothing more than the antics of a little girl who wanted to cause trouble and who was very, very clever." Ventriloquist Ray Allen visited the house and concluded that Janet's male voices were simply vocal tricks. A magician named Bob Cowdy said that after carefully listening to the recordings, he came to the conclusion that there was nothing in what he heard that was beyond the capabilities of an imaginative teenager. Professional skeptic Deborah Hyde has stated that there was no solid evidence of the Enfield poltergeist. According to her report, the first thing to note is that the occurrences didn't happen under controlled circumstances. People frequently see what they expect to see, their senses being organized and shaped by their prior experiences and beliefs. But on the other hand, those same skeptics have failed to explain the eyewitness accounts of people who were outside of the household and the investigation, who saw and heard incidents occur, including neighbors, journalists, and police officers. Now, I agree that it's very possible that many, maybe even most, of the incidents that occurred around the girls, from the flying objects to the levitations, could have been faked. Some of them, I think, almost undoubtedly were, like Janet's alleged levitation. In the movie, Janet raises high in the air and finds herself pinned against the ceiling. This is a complete exaggeration of what allegedly happened in real life during the Enfield haunting. Photographs of the real Janet levitating only show her a short distance above her bed. This, along with the way her body is positioned in the air, has led many people to believe that she simply jumped from her bed. But Janet swore it was real, as did two witnesses who claimed to see Janet hovering above her bed as they looked through an upstairs window from outside. But even if we agree that the photo of the so-called levitation looks a lot like her merely jumping off the bed, how do we dismiss the people who swore to the fact that they heard the knocking sounds or the police officer who witnessed the moving chair? It's very possible that for much of this case, the people involved saw what they expected to see. They believed that a poltergeist outbreak was occurring, and so they attributed everything that was happening to the paranormal. I think that it's more likely there was indeed some legitimate activity occurring, caused by stress, tension, and energy in the house, but the media attention paid to the case, as well as the attention from investigators, convinced Janet and Margaret to keep things going long after the genuine energy in the house had faded. Now, this is, of course, just my opinion, but it is something that commonly occurs in many poltergeist cases, which is what makes them so difficult to investigate. Far too often, things happen that cannot be explained, followed by other events that occur which are easily explained. And that often leads to the entire case being dismissed as fraud. So was the Enfield poltergeist case a fraud, or was there real activity occurring in the house? Well, I'm afraid the only answer we have for that is that it, quote, remains a mystery. I know you've heard me say it before, but unfortunately, it happens far too often. The arguments both for and against the authenticity of what happened in North London in the late 1970s, well, both sides seem to have equal merit, making it impossible to know for sure what happened there. But what we do know for sure was a hoax was the Warrens' involvement in the case. There's no way that this film can legitimately be billed as based on the true case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Why do I see this? Because I don't think that a single afternoon qualifies as enough time for you to claim you were involved in, well, much of anything. In 1977, hot on the heels of the publicity they received after the Amityville horror case, which is shown in the cold open of the film, the Warrens claimed that they investigated the happenings in Enfield, undoubtedly drawn there by all the press the case was getting at the time. Before they even arrived at the Hodgson home, several independent observers dismissed this case as a hoax carried out by attention-hungry children. But the Warrens would, of course, state that it was a case of demonic possession. Although how they know to trot out their usual explanation for this case is baffling, since even sources sympathetic to the Warrens admit that they were, quote, involved to as far lesser degree than portrayed in the movie. And that's being generous. The couple were not sent to investigate the case for the church. They showed up at Peggy's house uninvited. She had no idea who they were, and initially, they were refused entrance to the house. Guy Playfair, who actually did investigate the case with Morris Gross, confirmed this. He added that they, quote, turned up once, and that the only conversation he had with them was when Ed pulled him aside and told him that he could make a lot of money off the case. Now, I think making a lot of money off the case says it all when it comes to the Warrens. Unfortunately, the lives of the Hodgson family were much sadder and more tragic in the wake of the alleged haunting. The family faced a number of challenges after the events subsided and the press attention faded. The oldest of the two Hodgson boys, Johnny, was diagnosed with cancer soon after the events ended, and he died a few years later at the age of only 14. Billy stayed in the house with his mother until Peggy died from breast cancer in 2003. Janet married young and left home at only 16. She also lost a son who died in his sleep at the age of 18 and has struggled throughout her life. especially when she's accused of perpetrating a hoax that fooled Guy Playfair, Morris Gross, and scores of others. To this day, though, Janet rejects any suggestion that the whole story was faked in pursuit of fame or money. In an interview, she stated very clearly, "I don't care whether people believe me or not. I went through this, and it was true." Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the post-mortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors. Okay, fuck, I gotta start over. Jesus. I gotta fix this microphone too. All right, now I think we're good. All right, let me try that again. All right, I'm gonna quit stalling, I swear to God.
You're good, you're okay.
Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we are back with the American Hauntings podcast, the postmortem after the episode, where we dissect this week's show. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the guy who narrates, writes, and continues to conjure up, haha, bad puns and stories for the show. And across from me is the guy who simply refuses to admit that he once levitated, my friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host, Cody Beck.
I continue to refuse that. I will admit I had to sit through that twice.
The movie?
No, the intro.
I thought you meant the film. I'm like, God, I've seen it twice too. Once when it came out and once when I had to watch it for this, and I'm never watching this one again.
So. I like this one.
Do you really? I can't stand it. I don't know why. I know we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but I just, it's so forced. And so all this stuff they crammed in here just to make it part of the universe that doesn't belong in it, it just drives me crazy.
I can understand that.
I can't help it. So I think it bounces back with the third one. I mean, just as ridiculous when it comes to reality. But on the other hand, at least it's just a better put together film. So anyway, That's just my opinion. And we're not even to that part of the episode yet.
So. No. We'll get there. We got a couple things we got to go through beforehand. So we talked about your immediate plans after this, but what else you got coming up? I don't know what you can talk about, which you can't. So,
I can talk about the fact that I'm leaving here as soon as we're done recording this so I can get on a jet plane and fly out of here to L.A. I've got to do some more filming for apparently it's not called Unexplained. It's called History's Greatest Mysteries. I don't know why I keep calling it that, because it's the other show that I did. A few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I did the Unexplained, the Dan Aykroyd one, which I'm probably not supposed to say, but who cares? This one is the Lawrence Fishburne one that is, I believe, on the History Channel. But anyway, I'm going to film some more episodes. But one that I did last year is going to be on next week in between our weeks of the show. So next Monday, April 28th, I believe, last I heard, it's going to air. It's History's Greatest Mysteries about John Dillinger and his mysterious death. So that's supposed to air next Monday night. So I assume it's going to. I haven't heard any difference. So I guess we'll find out. But anyway, besides that, I got other stuff coming up. In May. May is going to be a busy month. The weather gets better. People still, people are wanting to get out and do some things. So we've got a lot of dinner tours planned for next month. We've got dinners, events at the museum with H.H. Holmes, Haunted Hollywood, Gangs of Southern Illinois, a bunch of different stuff. Plus our regular tours are starting out in Alton and Springfield. And we're even doing some in Decatur. This summer, nice. This spring and summer, which we don't normally do, but we thought it might be kind of fun. So we thought we'd add a few going into the fall season. So yeah, lots of stuff coming up, plus the conference, of course, the Haunted America conference coming up in the end of June. I still have people who are telling me, oh yeah, I got to get signed up for that. Yeah, you do. You need to get signed up for that, especially if you're wanting to do any of the after hour events, because they are dwindling quickly. Because every time people sign up, most of them sign up for those too, and so there isn't a whole lot left. And we are we're approaching our numbers for last year already. So things are it's going to be a really fun event, and you don't want to miss it. So if you want to check out the tours and stuff, go to dinnerandspirits.com. Or go to ghostconference.net for the Haunted America conference. So, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll see everybody there. I wanted to give a quick shout out to our latest subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show. To Shannon, Angie, Kelly, Donna, Stephanie, and Kevin. And as of if you're listening to this recording, then that means if you're one of the Haunted Spooky Shirt subscribers, you should have an email in your inbox about the April shirt. So get back to me about what shirt you want. And thanks again for supporting the show.
Yeah, thanks for doing that, because it's been fun. I just put together the next episode, the one for next week, of Monster, of our new season about Albert Fish. So which has been the grossest, nastiest, most horrendous of podcasts I've ever written in my entire life. But anyway, we have that and four other seasons for you to binge. And we offer that extra show, this kind of an alternative podcast. When I say we're doing, you know, episodes about Albert Fish, we've done episodes on Bell Gunness and H.H. Holmes and Ed Gein, a bunch of different stuff, Texas Chainsaw Massacre mixed with that Ed Gein thing. So we run that show every other week in between the regular run of this show. So you get a new episode every week. So if you are interested in checking that out, just go to patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I want to jump into a user review or listener review that we had rather. And this one is from Cheshire JW, and it's titled Time to Sign Up for Patreon. It says, this February, I started a hunt for a new paranormal podcast since I was already caught up with my others. During my search, saw Troy's name, and I knew this was the one since I've been long familiar with his books. I was right. The stories and Cody's efforts to make grim stories not so dark adds to a great combination. After 2 months of only listening to this podcast, I'm finally caught up. Guess it's time to listen to more content from them on Patreon. And guess what? They did. They did up for Patreon.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So, yes. So thank you.
Nice.
Thank you very much for signing up. I mean, grad school stuff, that's not
that's fun stuff. You need a break from all that. I mean, that's what I keep telling people, between the podcasts and the events and the dinners, I think we all need a break in the chaos around us in the world these days. I think we can all use a break. So but thank you for leaving that review. And we do actually, I would call it a bribe, I would call it a reward. Because it helps us. It really does help us when we get a review, the reviews that get left for us on iTunes and other places, it does help the show. It helps us grow. And if you want to keep us around, we love to get reviews. And if you do leave us one, we will be reading one. And if you hear your review pop up, get in touch with us. Drop us a text on the Haunt Line if you hear your review. That's at 217-791-7859. And we'll send you some cool merch stuff in the mail. So, yeah, I guess it is sort of a bribe, but call it a reward instead. But
there you go.
Thank you. Anyway, we appreciate it.
All about the angle. I also wanted to give a quick shout out randomly. One of my buddies, I used to work with him. His name is Sam. He's a super cool guy. And he reached out to me about, they were looking for some position for something, but we started talking, and he's always been a big supporter of the podcast, even back in the day. And he coincidentally now works with someone who said, he said that they were, quote, our biggest fan here in St. Louis. That's a big shoes to fill, but I wanted to give a quick shout out to Mandy. So thank you very much, Mandy, for listening to the show. We're mostly doing this to see if you freak out and, you know, hope this makes your day a little bit better. It's always nice when people reach out saying, like, man, somebody I know loves your show. And I'm like, what's wrong with them? But let's dive into this. I'd heard about the Itfield Poltergeist way before The Conjuring 2, and then I didn't even realize exactly that that's what it was, I guess, when I first watched the movie. Mm-hmm. And so then, because I'd heard about it because it was a famous event, but didn't remember hardly anything about it. And then I think it was actually probably you that kind of really brought it to my attention. It's like, no, those are the same. Those are supposed to be the same thing.
Yeah, supposed to be the same thing. There is a, which I recommend, there is a miniseries that's available. I know it's on Hulu. I'm not sure if it's available anywhere else, but it's just called The Enfield Poltergeist. And it's 4 or 5 episodes, a British series. You know, they're usually about that number of episodes. And it tells a story from a more accurate point of view. It does kind of the same thing that I've always done with this story, and then go, well, this is what they say. I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't there. I can't tell you if it was a hoax or not, but it does present it from the view of Morris Gross, mm-hmm. and Guy Playfair, the actual investigators who were involved in this, as well as a number of people that were involved with the SPR and things that were truly in the investigation, not. Not the people that stopped by for an afternoon and mm-hmm. then, you know, went on their way. So yeah, it gives a little bit more credibility. I mean, there's no demon nuns or, mm-hmm. you know, the crooked man or anything else that we can say that we put stuff in our museum. And even though we didn't, because we weren't there long enough to steal anything. And, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Don't even get me started on that. I just, well, I guess you have to get me started on it, but it is, it's just, I don't know. It bothers me. This episode, writing it, and this episode, when I was forced to rewatch this movie again, I remembered why I was irritated with it in the first place. For some reason, I just have a hard time. I mean, in the first Conjuring movie, I can put it out of my head and go, you know, comic book characters, whatever, you know, this one just bugs me. Just because it isn't their story. I mean, you know, they spread the word. I mean, they didn't write the book or anything about the first Conjuring film, about the Perrin house, but they were more involved in it. And, you know, with number three, they were definitely involved in that farce. But, mm-hmm. you know, this one, they're not even involved in this. And I think that's what bugs me about it. I just have a hard time. I mean, it's not even the ghost stuff in it or anything else. It's the hard time I'm having by just bending reality, putting these two characters into it.
Right.
And about the time the guitar comes out and he mm-hmm. starts singing Elvis songs, I'm like, I can't do it anymore. I can't.
Probably the worst part of the movie. just out of left field and just, what are we doing here?
Yeah, I know. I know.
I do like the investigators in this one, though, the two characters in the film, I thought they were really cool. They were fun. I like the guy's mustache and stuff and all that. And
they sort of made them sort of buffoonish.
And
it is like, man, these people know more than you will ever know about this stuff. You know, they know more reality than you've been able to make up, you know, so that's the way they're portrayed. And then, you know, at the beginning, the Amityville thing. And I thought, oh, well, this really gives the film credibility here.
Yeah.
And talk about their seance and all this stuff at the Amityville house. And, you know, and then they go to the talk show and they've got, I can't even think of his name off the top of my head. And I like that guy that passed away that wrote the book about the hoax, but they've got him on there as a character and who says everything that's accurate about none of it's true. And then, you know, they're all bent out of shape about it, you know, mm-hmm. and I thought, okay.
Oh,
but again, they try to make him look like the bad guy when he's really just spouting the facts, the real story behind it, but whatever. Anyway.
I forgot that that's how this movie starts out with the Amityville stuff.
And I did too.
When I started watching it again, I was like, damn, maybe Troy's going to be right. And actually this one does suck. But then I watched it through and all the stuff that I liked about it, I still liked.
That's all right. I mean, if you can put aside, you know, the silliness of it and watch it, I'm sure it's great. This is just one I have a problem with and I shouldn't be that way, but.
I get it. I think most of what I like is just Bill Wilkins and just like, just because like a crotchety old man, just like my house, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
because I mean, yeah, that. he's the character I related to the most.
Right? of course,
crotchety old man character.
Something we don't talk about too much regarding Poltergeist activity and things. At least I'm saying you and I don't talk about it too much. But people saying that when, you know, Legos and this and that things flew across the room, that they were hot when they picked them up, mm-hmm. Or warm, yeah. At least, you know, it's an interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too.
As far as, you know, if you're gonna believe, okay, well, there's got to be some kind of energy that, like, literally energy, sure, that pushes these things or moves them around. Yeah. And so the fact that they'd be warm, it's something I, you know, haven't really thought about too much. And then I also just, I love a prankster, and, you know, little kids, you know, just up to their hijinks and stuff. So this is,
yeah, I don't know. Did you dig into this at all as far as any of the photos and stuff?
Yeah.
So you have seen the photo when Janet's supposedly levitating.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. She's literally just jumping off the bed. I mean,
I know. And I
was sitting
there.
It's a picture of a kid jumping on a bed. I have pictures of myself doing that as a kid, you know.
I'm thinking about it. When I was looking at the pictures, I'm thinking, like, okay, how would I do this? How would I do it better? It's like, I'd probably jump and try to land and bounce and then, like, you know, get a picture, but have my sheets, like, tied down so they're not flying with me. Or I don't know. I was trying to figure out how to do it. But one of the things I love is that the kids, when they get caught doing stuff, saying, like, they fake some of it just to see if they get caught.
Oh, yeah, because that's what you always say.
Yeah, I mean, and it's such a thing where it's so hard to, like, disprove that that's why they were doing it. And,
right.
You know, but it's like, it's like one of those things my mom used to be like, I can always tell when you're lying, but, like, I can't prove it kind
right,
of thing.
Right, right.
Yeah, the Bill Wilkins voice, like I said, and seeing him, like, in the reflection of the TV. And I love when the remote drops in the background, you know, with the TV.
It has its moments. I'm not saying it doesn't.
Oh, I know.
I mean, I'm not saying it's a poorly made film or anything. I just they weren't there.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so them being there is completely a distortion of reality. But then when we bring in the, you know, we invent the crooked man thing, which was not part of the story. And then, you know, the nun thing is just, mm-hmm. I mean, that, okay. The nun in this film is the equivalent of the Ewoks in Return of the Jedi.
Sure.
But all they are is marketing. They are marketing toys. And so the nun was just a marketing thing so they could build their universe.
Yeah.
And it annoys me. Just like the Ewoks did. It annoys me. And so, I mean, you know, you've taken otherwise really good film and stick talking, you know, teddy bears in there. And it's like, okay. And this is an otherwise decent film that you've got to stick a nun in for no reason. Absolutely zero reason whatsoever. It just doesn't make any sense. And then make it like the star of the film. Oh, yeah. It's right here blocking, you know, Lorraine from believing or seeing what's really happening and all this stuff. And I'm like, what? What has that got to do with anything? You know,
it is bizarre.
I mean, I know if I want the real story, then watch a documentary, right?
Sure.
I get it. So there are all kinds of things that people can say, you know, in defense of the film and to say that I'm wrong on my feelings about it. And I agree. I mean, I'm fine with that. I understand it. But I still just have trouble getting past it. So
no, I understand. And I mean, I can't blame them for some of it. When you mentioned like toys and things like that, just like merchandising Star Wars, like Pixar's Cars, I think is one of the most
like,
successful film franchises just because of the merchandise more so than And I mean, they're setting up their whole universe and
Toy Story.
Yes, of course.
You know, how many Woody dolls do you think sold, you know?
I know.
Or Buzz Lightyears.
My little brother had them both. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know, okay, somebody can look this up and correct me, but I did look into it at one point, but Crooked Man is also in the Hellboy universe. And I believe it comes down to like some comic book rights or something.
It's different. Yeah.
Is it?
That's something different. The Crooked Man that's in Hellboy is not the same as because the Crooked Man essentially is kind of the way they present it in this film. It is an old nursery rhyme,
right?
You know, there was a crooked man, it had a crooked house, you know, that guy.
Yes.
But the Crooked Man in Hellboy is completely different.
Well, so the reason I was thinking about it is because I looked it up and I think at the end of the day, they were writing, the same company was making Conjuring comic books. And so I thought that maybe that's how they were able to do the crossover with the Hellboy comic. The same people that were making Hellboy comics were making Conjuring comics. But you're saying they're still two different.
That's something completely different. Gotcha. The Crooked Man in Hellboy is just a character from this 1950s set storyline where Hellboy is in Appalachia. Actually did a movie of it that no one knows about.
Yep.
Because it came out in England and it got no release here at all. And it's really good.
No shit.
I love Hellboy. So I'm a Hellboy.
Okay.
Nut. I mean, I had a huge collection of Hellboy stuff. But when I saw the movie first come out in England, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to order this disc for, you know, I got an all regions DVD player. And then it came out here, but straight to on demand.
Yeah.
But it is available. If you do a search for it, it's out there and it's definitely worth watching.
I think I'm going to have to check it out.
Yeah. It's not a Hellboy. It's not Ron Perlman and it's not
David Harbour.
It's a different guy, but he does a good job. Hmm. I mean, he's not quite as big as those two are, but he's still Hellboy. So, I mean, you know, the writing is still great. I mean, they take it right out of the comics. So
nice.
Good stuff. Yeah.
That's awesome. And you said that this is a strange thing, because usually when the priests show up, it's not always the best thing, but you know, the priest visit ends actually the worst of a lot of the activity.
Yeah, which I think was probably about over by then.
Yeah.
Because in most cases like this, and I think this is something that I mentioned in this, is that most of the time this stuff, and I don't know how often we've talked about this before, but I know we have some, but usually that stuff just sort of winds up, gets hot and heavy, and then it just sort of cools off and fades away. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what happened here. And I think that by the time, I think the girls did probably, and this happens a lot too, this is another one of those things that happens a lot with poltergeist cases, is the people who are at the center of it, the one that the activity seems to be centering around, all of their problems, their mental issues and all their anxiety and things is what causes this stuff to happen in the first place. But then they start getting attention and become the center of activity and things. And because of that, they tend to not be quite as upset and anxious as they were. And so things drop off. But loving the attention, a lot of times they will, because, you know, this stuff gets started because they're having behavioral issues in the first place, they will often, you know, keep stuff going, you know, to try to keep the attention coming. And then that's when they get caught. Yep. It's always right toward the end when things have already slowed down. And I think that's probably what happened in this case. Mm-hmm. You know, the girls got caught doing a couple of things. And then after that, it just sort of faded away and it was over. And then, unfortunately, then everything that happened early on often gets ignored, especially by the debunkers and things. They'll come in and go, oh, but look, they got caught. Well, yeah, they got caught 2 weeks after 50 people witnessed things that they, you know, couldn't explain. But now we're going to go with, oh, they got caught, you know, doing something dumb. And so a lot of times this stuff gets dismissed and gets forgotten. And this is one that didn't. But there are still an awful lot of people who didn't believe it was real. I mentioned a lot here toward the end, that there were a lot of people involved who just said, I looked at this and, well, no, I wasn't there, but I read about it and it couldn't happen kind of thing. So there's a lot of that. And, you know, that happens too.
Yeah, it's not the right phrase, but it's like fruit of the poisonous tree or something like that or whatever.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And I did like talking about people speculating on it. And one of the magicians said the poltergeist was nothing more than the antics of a little girl who wanted to cause trouble and who was very, very clever. Like, I do love that.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Clever little son of a bitch. Like, yeah. I love it. And then as portrayed in the movie, you know, the Catholic Church goes begging the Warrens to go over there. That's what happened. Oh, no. They showed up unannounced.
Unannounced, as usual. You know, just like they did at the parent house. I mean, they didn't even know they were coming, had no idea who they were. Same thing again, you know, the mom had, you know, no idea who these people were, who just show up there.
She's got enough on her plate.
that's always what is funny about it is that, you know, they even admitted, I mean, there were people who admitted that, so the Warrens weren't really involved the way they are in the movie. And I'm like, Yeah, that's being generous. I mean, an hour and an afternoon is they're limited their involvement, you know, and the and you know, Peggy's like, get out of here. You know, it's just bizarre. So
yeah. And then so after the debacle and everything, the family still goes through some hard stuff. Johnny ends up dying at 14. Janet loses a son when she's about 18. And you just ended it with, you know, her saying, I don't care whether people believe me or not. I went through this and it was true. What are you going to do? It's, you know.
Yeah, I know. She's never, ever said that she, I mean, there have been instances where, you know, her and her sister have been kind of like, well, you know, I don't know if I'd call it haunted. And then one of them tells the other one to shut up. And I mean, that was an interview. And then, you know, there are times when, you know, I don't know, kind of hesitated on things. So, but she still insists that it really happened. So, you know, something happened. I mean, and maybe, you know, something happened that to a lesser degree of what was reported, you know, I mean, that pops up a lot, you know, I mean, we even talk about the Amityville house, you know, maybe it was haunted. It just wasn't what they said it was, you know, and maybe that's the same case with this. I wouldn't necessarily even call the house haunted, but there might have been something going on there, you know, and yet it got blown up when all the attention ended up on it. It got blown up into something that it really wasn't. So, you know, obviously this movie is blown up into something that it right. wasn't. But, right? you know, as far as real life, it could have been kind of the same thing.
So, yes. Well, hey, is there anything that we missed that you want to go back over?
No, no, please don't make me talk about the Warrens. This one again. Yeah. No, I got to talk. We still have to talk about the Warrens. We're not done, but we'll get more into the Warrens, but I just don't want to talk about this movie anymore.
Right.
I'm serious. Not going to watch this again. okay. I have, this is the only one that I've never rewatched of this.
Wow. Series.
Until now, just for this, I rewatched it. So
wow. The first time I watched the third one, I didn't really care for it, and I have never rewatched it again. So I'm excited to see
I like the third one. I mean, it's again, it's blown out of proportion. And you know, yeah. I watched a great documentary. There was a great documentary about the third one, The Devil Made Me Do It thing, which I would call a must-see watch after you've seen this movie.
Okay.
Really watch the documentary because it's got everybody in it. I mean, it's got all of the real people that are alive are in this documentary talking about, let's just say a lot of things that weren't exactly accurate in the story that was told.
Shit.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. So including the kid that was supposedly possesses in it and everything. It's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Hey, well, so I'll check that out.
I recommend it.
Well, it is now time for our Ghost Rider segment. So if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This message comes to us from Jennifer. And Jennifer writes, hello, guys. I want to say that I love the podcast. I only listen to two paranormal podcasts, and I recommend them to everyone who's looking for a paranormal fix. I'm a paranormal enthusiast myself. I love the passion and the honesty that you convey. You've made many grad school assignments so much more enjoyable. That's what I was mentioning earlier review. I do plan on coming to Alton for a girls' weekend. What are your recommendations? The museum is a planned stop. Museum, definitely. You got to check that out.
Yeah, you can always try and do it on a weekend when we've got some other stuff going on, because we usually do, especially now that it's getting to nicer weather. Our weekends are, you know, we'll either have a tour probably that weekend or a dinner event or both. So, I mean, either one might be fun, and then you can make a visit to the museum as well. So that would be my recommendation. Our walking tours will get started. We have those almost every weekend in the summer. So
there's lots
of things to do for sure.
Check out AmericanHauntingsInc.com and you'll find a bunch of different stuff around there about what's going on. Yeah. Try to make a whole, make a weekend out of it and just let American Hauntings take care of, all your paranormal needs.
We can pretty much do it all. Yeah.
you got anything from the haunt line?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As I mentioned, or as Cody mentioned, you can email him at the address he mentioned, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com, or you can text us on the hotline. And that number again is 217-791-7859. And it might get read on the show. I've got quite a few, so we'll see what we can get through here if we've got time for. So this one comes to us from the 586. And it says, "Hey, friends, I'm currently listening to the Conjuring House episode, and I had two thoughts. A, I feel like it's absolutely believable that with that many young, small adults in various stages of teenagerdom, that the phone call is coming from inside the house, as it were. The sheer amount of emotion or hormones in the house could either attract or cause supernatural experiences." And that kind of goes along with this episode too, actually. And B, thank you for not going into the madness that's happening with the Conjuring House right now, which we are not going to. So if you're worried about that, look it up yourself. So this one comes to us from Stephanie in, let's see, where is she? Stephanie in the, I'm trying to get to, oh, she's in the 217. Well, that was easy. So this says, "I'm listening to the most recent episode of the podcast, and it was mentioned Raggedy Ann isn't really scary." We were talking about Annabelle and being a Raggedy Ann. She said, "My kiddos, who are 14 and 20, will argue with that one. A lovely older lady at our church gave them a Raggedy Ann doll about 6 years ago. They politely thanked her, and when we got home, I put it in the toy net that holds all of our youngest stuffed animals. Both of our kids moved her and buried her deep in the pile because they want nothing to do with her. I threatened to start moving her around the house. My oldest said she would start a bonfire, use salt and holy water, and burn the doll if it showed up anywhere in her room."
Wow.
That's funny.
That's awesome. Oh, I followed up about the doll that my sister had back in the day. And apparently Nona got rid of it a while back because it was too much. So that one's gone too. So yeah, you're not alone with the creepy dolls.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, hey, this one is from Bryce. He is from the 480, as he calls it, the Thunderbird country. And this is like a, I didn't realize this is like a, it's an entire book here, Bryce. Anyway, these are supposed to be concise, but that's all right. I'm just teasing.
Concise, Bryce.
Anyway, it says, "Hey, Troy, Bryce here again from Thunderbird Country. Really enjoying the latest season. Just listen to the Conjuring episode. I've always believed the Warrens to be absolutely shameless bamboozlers. I guess the snake oil salesman has never really gone away, has he? Anyway, I had a question for you regarding your other podcast about Albert Fish. I've read a great deal about the Werewolf of Wisteria over the years. Gotta say, I agree with this jury. Okay, we're not, that's spoiler alerts there. We're not going to get into that. But my question is, why do you think Albert Fish, given just the absolute horrific depravity and almost demonic nature of him, isn't talked about more amongst American serial killers? A lot of people talk about BTK and Gacy, Dahmer. They're so embedded in our culture that they've become iconic movie characters, or at least aspects of them have. But for as sick as they were, although Ed Gein wasn't a serial killer, Fish has them beat. And yet, aside from a few places on the internet, he's relatively unknown. I thought at first it's because he operated over a century ago for the most part, and people are just out of touch with the past, except many people know about H.H. Holmes, who was doing his things around the same time, actually even earlier. So I said that. I have my own ideas, but I was curious why you think he isn't mentioned amongst some of the morbid MVPs. He has the accolades for it. Well, I think that, and the short answer to that is that, yes, he was a serial killer, but so many of his victims remain unknown. We do know about a few disappearances that he confessed to. And of course, we know about what he did to Grace Budd, which, again, he confessed to. But as far as, you know, the claims that there were probably dozens of other victims, and there probably were, it's just that no one could trace them because he was smart enough to target mostly poor, working class, tenement living people in New York, in, you know, Brooklyn and Queens. And people were, you know, lived in low cost, and some of them maybe even didn't get reported. Some of them did, but the police didn't look very hard. And I think that because we're so unsure of his numbers, I think that's a big part of it. But he is, I think, almost too much for some people. He's so horrific. And some of the things that he did are almost, you know, to the point where it's almost impossible to believe how sick this guy was. But, you know, the evidence is all there. And I'm not going to get too deep into that because I don't want to spoil the podcast that's still coming for anybody. But anyway, Bryce, here back. As a side note, I can be linked to a few different serial killers in less than 3 degrees.
Oh,
that's scary.
It's Kevin Bacon.
My
this
dad
up.
Wrote a book that Gary Ridgway almost wrote the foreword to. He also had some clients back in the 80s who were liked by Richard Ramirez. My grandfather was bunkmates and brief friends with Charles Whitman during boot camp. That's the sniper guy in Texas. I had a great aunt who was almost kidnapped by Bundy. He tried the old broken arm near the van trick and she didn't fall for it. Another great aunt was a member of the Manson family, although an inconsequential one, and an ex-girlfriend who went to school with the Columbine shooters and was there the day they went on their rampage. I thought you might find that interesting and fun. I don't know about fun, but interesting, but keep up the great work. Cheers.
Well, that's amazing, too, because Bryce, it looks like they just announced on Netflix an Albert Fish movie starring Timothy Chalamet. So I think he's
really
no. Come on.
OK, I was to say what? Well, I mean, they do have that Ed Gein.
I know.
Coming with Charlie Hunnam. But
I know.
Anyway.
I was just thinking.
OK,
of, like, who's
you
the most
kind
ridiculous.
Of freaked me out there for a minute. I thought, what? All right. I mean, a movie would be cool. I was thinking about that today, but I don't know who it would be. I bet I could think of somebody who it could be. Anyway, all right. So this one comes to Brenda in the 607. I says, I love the podcast. 1 month on end catching up. Months on end catching up, starting at episode 1. I've been following the Conjuring House real life drama and can't help but wonder if the spirits that are experienced at the house today were conjured up by the visitors. With the house being empty, will those spirits fade away now? What are your thoughts? Again, I don't want to get into all that stuff with the current stuff. Do I think that it's possible that things were conjured up, so to speak, in recent times by visitors to the house? Absolutely. That was one of the things I said, that, you know, suddenly 40 years after, you know, the last activity, it's suddenly haunted again. They're either conjured up by the visitors or they're conjured up by, you know, the owners of the house. Right. I don't know. It's hard to say. Anyway, this one comes to us from Christy in the 317. Says, I've been listening to the podcast since season 1. I made it to one dinner so far. This year I was at dead of winter and did the River Road tour the night before. So I bought a couple of books that I had Troy ruin with his signature. You guys are, because that's what I do. You guys are amazing. Thanks for everything you do. And then she adds, how about a season on Haunted Indiana? Well, probably not a whole season that would be Haunted Indiana, but we have had some Indiana stories in the podcast. You know, Herb Baumeister would pop up right away as someone who we did an Indiana episode about. Plus, we've got the Bill Gunness entire season on Patreon. So we actually have done some stuff on Indiana. But anyway, this one comes to us from Michelle. Let's see, where is she from? Well, I don't know. She sent a text with email. So we don't know. But I'm going to say she's probably somewhere in Connecticut or in that area, because she says, guys, longtime listener here, American Haunting's my favorite podcast. I have a request. Before you're completely done with the Warrens, can you please consider doing an episode on 966 Lindley Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut? They played a very small part. The case fascinates me with tales of a talking cat. Well, that sounds like the Warrens. And eyewitness accounts from neighbors and the police. They even have recorded accounts from the police. I hope you'll consider doing an episode. I love how thorough your research is and would love to hear it. Take care and keep up with the great entertainment. Would love to see you in New England someday. Well, the thing is, unless they made a movie from it, we won't get to it this season, because we're pretty much sticking to the stuff that there are movies on, and which means that currently we have 2 more episodes to go that include the Warrens in one way or another. So we probably won't do that one, but you never know. I cannot say that we'll never do it, but it's very possible. So, all right. So we're almost done here. So I'm going to go ahead and finish this up. This one comes to us from the 281. This one says, hey, Troy and Cody, I'm from a small suburb of Houston, Tomball, Texas. We have some haunts here, but I wanted to talk to you about Old Town Spring. The whole town is haunted. I really do encourage you to check it out. It's been on several haunted type shows, but we all know how reliable those are. Well, I haven't seen anything firsthand, I've heard about incidents. Our family moved to Spring when I was 14, so I spent my high school years there. After going to Old Town to look at the shops and eat and go to the annual Crawfish Festival, I absolutely believe there is something paranormal there. A lot, if not most, of the buildings have been moved from other locations and seem to have some kind of activity. I have a great friend from high school who owned land and was trying to build a house in Old Town Spring that had several paranormal issues to the point where the contractors refused to work, and she ended up not building there. Now, she may, but she hasn't. So be willing to talk to her about her. She may be willing to talk about her paranormal experiences. This is my cell. Feel free to call or text. Love the podcast. Yeah, interesting. I'm familiar with Spring. I've been to quite a few places in Texas. I don't think I've spent any time in Spring, but someday I hope to make it there. It'd be kind of cool. So we'll have a Texas-related episode coming up in a few weeks, actually. So nice. It won't be too long. Yeah. So anyway, this is our last one for this time. And it comes for us to Josh in the 818. Says, hey, guys, it's Josh. We're listening to the Conjuring episodes. Tragic to hear the false history. Some of the most haunted, but I appreciate the true history. People need to grow up and realize facts are facts. And you're just telling it the way it is. Love listening. You've got my support of the truth. And that's from Josh. So that was nice.
Nice.
But that's not why people leave us bad reviews. It has nothing to do with us telling true stories. It has everything to do with people who've just decided they don't like us. And that's okay, too, because I don't like them either. So, hey, it's easy to go. Anyway, so, guys, if you have something that you'd like to ask a question about or something you'd like to send us, send it to the hotline. It's 217-791-7859.
And if you want to know what they would do is they would have to use the reverse of the de-aging technique from the Irishman. They do it to Timothy Chalamet. They'd age.
Oh my God. They're not going to do this. I thought, oh my God. I thought you were serious for a second. I almost fell out of my chair.
Nope.
Movie part, actually, I thought, oh wow. And then you said Timothy Chalamet. And I thought, he's lying.
I was trying to think of the most ridiculous person I could.
Well, that was pretty ridiculous. So
thank you. You want to take us out?
Sure. All right, guys. Thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show. If you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, strangers, or just people you randomly meet on the street, in the bus station, at the doctor's office. But be careful. Don't say it to the wrong people because you might get locked up or something. Anyway, encourage them to listen. If you get a chance, we hope you go to iTunes and leave us a review, even if you don't listen that way. And if you do leave a review, we'll be reading at least one review during every postmortem for you. Read yours. We'll send you some cool stuff in the mail. Anyway, it also helps us if you check your iTunes, if that's how you listen. Make sure that American Hauntings podcast is set to automatically download to your feed. That way you never miss a show, and it helps us out, and we will reward you for that also. We have a discount code you can use to get 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from American Hauntings. Just use the code podcast at checkout and save a few bucks on whatever you buy, because just remember, American Hauntings is more than just a podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. You can find everything about us on the website at AmericanHauntings.net.
All righty. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor and was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text, on the Haunt Line, or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, bunch of other places we don't really remember.
Yeah, I don't, and or use, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, we're out there. Thanks again for listening. We're not hard to find. We wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
All right, man. I'm going to go catch a plane.
Hey, okay. You don't have to catch it. You just got to get on it.
Well, okay. That'll work. So. All right. All right. See ya.
A lot of products say they're clean, but what does that mean? Ritual has high standards for what clean means, like their essential prenatal multivitamin, which is heavy metal tested, clean label project certified, and GMO-free. It features key mom-to-baby nutrients like folate, choline, and omega-3. Clean isn't clean enough, especially during pregnancy. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.